Let's call the Senate Special Committee on Oil and Gas to order. It is Wednesday, February 28th, 6:11 p.m. Present this evening, we have Senators Fisher and Kelly, myself, Senator Pierce, the chairwoman. Gentlemen, let me give you an idea of what you have before you in these huge folders. First of all, we have copies of last year's bills, pertinent bills that we passed in response to the oil spill. CS for Senate Bill 261, Senator Duncan's bills, which set up a mechanism using funds out of the 470 fund to do statewide response plans for emergencies. Also, Senator Kelly, your bill, 264, which established an oil and hazardous substance response office, a corps, and depots. We, in that folder also are copies for you of Alaska Statute Title 46, which you may or may not want to refer to. You have files of Senate Bills 503 and 504, which we will have our first introduction to this evening from Commissioner Kelso. In your file for Senate Bill 504 is also a report on tanker safety issues and the history of the tanker safety legislation from the late 1970s that was sponsored at that time by Chancey Croft and the legal machinations that got most of those thrown out of law in the late 70s and early 80s. You also have a copy of the executive summary of the Oil Spill Commission report, and you have Senator Halford's Senate Bill 468, which is an act relating to duties of the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs and the Department of Environmental Conservation in relation to oil, hazardous substances, and radioactive material. It has to do with some of the recommendations of the commission. My intention tonight is this. We will first have Commissioner Kelso, give us an update of the department's progress in instituting Senate Bills 261 and 264, the planning process and setting up of all those depots and corps that you, Senator Kelly, sponsored. We will then have he and Mr. McDonough give us an overview, the administrative overview on Senate Bills 503 and 504. After that, we have Walt Parker online from Anchorage, chairman of the Oil Spill Commission. We will have Mr. Parker give us the commission's response to, specifically to Senate Bills 503 and 504. That's all I plan for this evening. Starting tomorrow evening at 6:45, Alyeska is going to present an overview of the contingency plan process that they've been through in the Prince William Sound, which I think is we should understand how that's working because it fits into the responses. And then we'll begin public testimony on these two oil spill bills. This is a statewide teleconference tonight. It is listen only. Starting tomorrow evening, we will take testimony statewide. And with that, if there are no questions, Mr. Kelso. Mm-hmm. I think this will be pretty quick. Depends on the questions, but I would say 8 at the latest. That would be fine. I think the new bills are probably. Although you may want to know what's happening with the details. Commissioner, whenever you're ready, go ahead and start, and we appreciate your being here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think you summarized the essential elements of Senate Bills 261 and 264. I might mention one other bill that this committee gave a substantial amount of attention to last session. It is a very important bill. It's not part of this package this evening, but it is a crucial part of what you took last year, and that's Senate Bill 271. It's worth just bearing in mind as we go through the other provisions that you enacted in 261 and 264. Basically, 261 and 264 taken together provide for the statewide and regional oil and hazardous substance response plans. They also provide in Senate Bill 264 for the establishment of the Oil and Hazardous Substance Response Office. And as you mentioned, they provide as well for the equipping and training of the local volunteer corps as part of this effort. So I'll bring you up to date on what we're doing. I'll start with the establishment of the Oil and Hazardous Substance Response Office. I think that'll be somewhat shorter presentation than the other one, but I don't have a great deal of material here. I'd like to keep it as short as possible. I know you have a busy evening. The Oil and Hazardous Substance Response Office was established in the department. Our understanding of the intention of the legislature was that this office be directed toward the spill response function as a specialty. And we have named an acting response office director. He's located in Anchorage. His name is Joe Sautner. The acting director initiated the basic functions now and has been working on a variety of major issues, including the Drift River incident response, which of course is a particular concern right now. The acting director, Joe Sautner, has also been coordinating with local governments on the Kenai Peninsula to develop an integrated response capability for oil and hazardous substance response in Cook Inlet, which would be not identical to, but which would provide some of the same safeguards that we're looking for in Prince William Sound. We've also been coordinating with the oil and gas industry response organizations on the Kenai Peninsula. We have entered a contract with the Kenai Borough. The Kenai Borough is working directly with us in the efforts of the spill response office. They have designated a staff person to Jim Butler to work directly with us in exploring the various parts of the response preparation that we need there. And of course, we also have the Drift River issue, which is of greatest concern in the Kenai Peninsula borough. The response office has been activated for four major incidents since you took action on the bill. One is Drift River. One was the Crowley Maritime Barge, which was adrift and very, very narrowly avoided going aground on Thanksgiving Eve. And that would have gone aground just outside of Prince William Sound, and the resulting spill would have carried into the Sound. The Nemos Reefer is a four-flagged vessel which is aground and which spilled fuel in the Bering Sea.
What's the name of it again?
It's the Nemos Reefer, and it's spelled M-I-L-O-S, and the second word is R-E-E-F-E-R. I believe it's Greek registry. And the final one is the Frank H. Brown spill in southeast Alaska, which was a spill of just under 60,000 gallons of refined product. It was actually the second spill for the Frank H. Brown. We have also, in the course of beginning the work under the response office, developed specifications for heavy seas containment boom, for boom wheels, and for containment protection. This, of course, was particularly relevant in Cook Inlet and Prince William Sound. And we've also done a preliminary review for warehouse locations for both Prince William Sound and Cook Inlet, and that work is ongoing. We are also beginning discussions with the Department of Natural Resources in order to see if we can utilize some of the expertise in their forest firefighter crew, because they use a very sophisticated incident command system model. We're not suggesting using exactly that model, but we are committed to using the incident command system, and we would like to adapt it specifically for oil and hazardous spills. Maybe I could move on and give you the overview on the two planning efforts, the two major planning efforts, the state and regional contingency planning program. I can give you a few highlights, and then let me give you some of the information about what we're doing with those specific plans. We have initially developed a work plan with specific deadlines, and the intention is to have both the state plan, the statewide plan, and the regional plans submitted on July 1. The incident command system model will be...
These are the drafts, right?
That's correct.
Okay.
Obviously, the public will have a full role in this, and we want to keep you informed as well. The incident command system model will be adapted to meet the specific requirements here. There seems to be consensus that that's the appropriate model to use. We relied on it heavily during the response last summer to the Exxon Valdez spill, and the Alaska Oil Spill Commission recommended its adoption. We have created an interagency work group to make sure that the various agencies that may have a role in a response to either a spill of oil or other hazardous substances are involved in the development of the plans. And we have also invited interest groups such as coastal district coordinators, port directors, fishing organizations and others to make sure that they have an opportunity to participate in the basic development of these plans. The regions within which regional plans will be developed have been outlined. We have drafted regulations establishing those regions. Of course, that will be provide an opportunity for the public to comment on those. The boundaries are now being evaluated in light of the agency comments from the interagency working group. And we are in the process of developing a cooperative agreement, which is basically a support arrangement, a support agreement between the Department of Environmental Conservation and the Division of Emergency Services in the Division of Military and Veterans Affairs. So all of those things are happening right now. Let me describe to you specifically what we are doing in the state response plan. And while I'm doing that, I brought along some copies of the basic response organization, which is...
Erna, would you grab those and hand them around?
Which is keyed to incident command system, and which will also give you an idea of the agencies that have already been involved in the initial meetings. Basically, in the response plan on a statewide basis, we will be clarifying and specifying the responsibilities of all parties involved in the assessment, containment, and cleanup of oil discharge, a catastrophic oil discharge, or a significant discharge of hazardous substances. We'll be identifying response organization for state response to oil or hazardous substance spills, identifying the immediate actions for the first state representatives at the scene of the spill, establish training and the role for the volunteer response corps. We see that as not only an important part of the legislation, but also an important part of getting this spill response effort underway properly. We'll be explaining the communications needs and the plans for implementation of spill response communication systems, building on what we have learned from this last summer. We'll be laying out the spill notification procedures, outlining damage assessment procedures, and describing the emergency procedures for procurement, hiring, and permitting, and specifying criteria for evaluating performance of plan and response personnel during drills. Then, with respect to the response preparedness itself, we will be holding unannounced oil spill drills to test the sufficiency of these plans. A plan shouldn't be parked on a shelf. It ought to be a document that really generates the kind of response we're talking about, and so we will do unannounced drills. The plan will be reviewed and revised annually, and we will be providing procedures for annual plan review and revision so that the public has an adequate role. At the regional level, in the prevention arena, we'll be identifying region-specific actions necessary to reduce the likelihood of catastrophic oil discharges or significant discharges of other hazardous substances. We'll be doing that at the statewide level as well, but the prevention element is very important in all of this. And I think you'll remember that the Oil Spill Commission report emphasized prevention, and when we talk about the governor's package, prevention is a prominent element. With respect to the response planning at the regional level, we will provide a roster of local volunteer response corps, a call-out list for regional spill response personnel. We'll be identifying pre-designated command centers. We'll identify the facilities and transportation routes within the region where hazardous oil or hazardous substances are present. Identify the types of oil or hazardous substances that are located in these areas or that may be transported through them. And we'll be identifying emergency equipment available in the region for the spill response effort, including equipment at response equipment depots and other facilities. We'll describe the environmental character of the region as applicable to the response effort. For example, ocean currents, the sensitive habitat areas, the kinds of features that we need to be paying attention to in order for our spill response to be both effective and make sure we don't do damage in areas where we have particularly sensitive conditions. We'll also be identifying pre-approved solid and contaminated waste disposal sites in the region. We'll be identifying areas pre-approved for dispersant use, and of course that work is already underway. We'll be requiring or scheduling unannounced oil spill drills to test the sufficiency of the regional plans as well as the state plan, and we'll be providing the annual plan revision and review procedures, again, involving the public. It will also be critical, in our view, to establish and stock spill response equipment depots, and we've already begun the process of identifying the kinds of specifications that to apply. In the response preparedness, again, training and drills are essential. Simulated response exercises will be part of this, and we will also, of course, make sure that there is an adequate training element, especially because the local volunteer corps will be such an important part of this. They need to have the training not only to be effective, but also for their safety. And, of course, we will be establishing procedures for regularly ensuring that there is readiness for response personnel. So that's the approach we're taking. It's underway. We will be continuing to work with the interagency group. We have some specific deadlines for ourselves, and as you can see by the response organization, which is in draft form as well, there are the specific functions and the state agency resources are already being identified, so we can put the various pieces together.
Okay. Thank you very much. I have a couple of questions, and then Senator Fisher. One of the concerns that has been noted by the Wild Mayor's group, and I'm referring to the bill that we were dealing with last night, Senate Bill 359, there was a concern about the planning process having being conducted with the having the opportunity for the municipalities to be a part of that. What is your plan in terms of once this draft is ready on July 1st? Is there, you will go to public comment, and will you have hearings throughout the state, or have you gotten that far?
We intend to have public meetings. I don't know whether they'll be denominated hearings or not.
Okay.
But we don't intend to wait till July 1st to involve the municipalities. They have expertise that we need in this planning process from the beginning, and so we'll be working with them. In fact, we've already had a number of discussions with the Kenai Peninsula Borough. We've talked with some of the local members of the State Emergency Response Commission, and in fact, if the Redoubt Volcano allows travel, Mayor Don Gilman and I will be getting together with some of our staff tomorrow.
Okay.
So we plan to get that moving and keep it moving throughout this process.
All right. On in Senate Bill 264, under contracts, you were allowed to do contracts to conduct research into oil and hazardous substances, spill technology, and I heard you mention that you had initiated at least one contract looking at, did you say open water booms or some kind of booms?
We have, what I mentioned is that we had established specifications. We've
okay.
begun talking about exactly what kind of equipment you need in order to handle a spill in open water, which is, of course, mm-hmm. depending on the weather, it's the most demanding of the conditions. It's our expectation that the ultimate preparedness will depend on a combination of contracts and in-house expertise. We have, for example, in a related area, entered into a contract so that we have expertise from outside our agency in evaluating the oil spill contingency plan standards. That's an important contract that we want to make sure we have the best available expertise to help us tailor those standards and make any regulatory changes that we should. So we'll be using both that expertise and our own expertise. We entered a small contract for developing all of the pieces of this planning process and laying it out in a way that made sure we didn't leave anybody out. And so that's where we are so far, but we will actively use contracts as we get into this.
Having thought through this now for a period of months, is it your feeling, Commissioner, that the response office will be able to do an adequate job within the response office for conducting the research into technology? Do you feel that this is a proper place for that? Are you comfortable with it?
The response office will be able to do the information gathering that we need. I would expect that they would use contracts in order to accomplish that. There's no need to establish a separate research capability in-house when we can reach that expertise easily using contracts on a selective basis, and that's what we intend to do.
Okay, but you feel comfortable with the directives coming from the response office?
Yes.
In terms of getting the research done? Okay, thank you very much. I should note for the record that Senator Halford is now with us, and Senator Halford, as I'm sure is obvious, the Commissioner is speaking to the progress that's been made by the administration on last year's Senate Bills 261 and 264, and then we'll launch into the new bills after Senator Fisher asks his questions. Senator Fisher. We're on teleconference, Senator.
You have the state regional plan, I understand, it's coming in around July. Did Did you already plug in your budget anticipation of the plan being adopted in July as far as staff goes, contractual services, et cetera?
If the governor's budget request is funded, and if we have resources in the Oil and Hazardous Substance Spill Response Fund, along with what was already built in, I believe there was a fiscal note accompanying this last year, the resources are there. So we have budgeted for these functions and we'll be able to carry out the work.
Do you have any money to do? How many positions you're talking about that would be tied in just with this?
I can get you that information very easily.
Also, when you talk about local volunteers or volunteers, are these people who work no fee, or is there a fee connected with them, they're paid to be on standby, or whatever? Very strictly, but I call a volunteer no pay.
Well, I would expect that we would look to the municipalities and other local communities to give us some guidance on what they think would work the best. My expectation is that given the nature of this effort and the fact that they need to be trained and they need to be on standby, that some form of compensation for the time that they spend in training and in spill drills and so forth would be appropriate. But again, we'll have to see what the local communities suggest would be the most effective way of handling that.
Okay, so if the local community through the hearing process says that we think they should be paid volunteers, then that's most likely what we end up with.
Well, I think we have to look at what their recommendations are specifically. It is not our intention to have a standing professional strike team, which we would be paying on a year-round basis, represented by the volunteer corps. I don't think that's what the legislation contemplated. Instead, what I'm suggesting is that volunteers shouldn't be in a position where they have to incur costs themselves for training and other safety equipment and other essential elements of getting this work done. So I'm not suggesting and not really thinking of a corps that would be paid on a year-round basis, but I'd like to know what the local officials think about that approach. Am I understanding your question?
Yeah, I guess my concern is we use the term volunteer sometimes pretty loose. I know a fire company is called volunteers. They make a heck of a lot more than any of us do in the ministry. Because they call them volunteers, but they're not volunteers and paid. Okay, the other question I have, Madam Chairman, is when we talk about response depots, how do you envision those? Could you go a little bit into how you're going to, are you going to have people there around the clock to be able to open the door? Or is that going to be something that's going to be sitting there to pay the rent on the building? It's not going to be managed, but you also say response depots that are equipped to staff. And I'm just wondering if you see the depots being unstaffed, are you actually going to have, three shifts just so somebody sits there and you break open the door if you need to equip?
I think I can give you a good picture of that. Madam Chair, with your permission, I'd ask Larry Dietrich to join me up here.
That'd be great. And Larry, I wanted to apologize to you because you were very patient with me when I was very tired and a real space cadet last night, and I appreciate it. I'm not as tired tonight, so perhaps it won't be as awful.
Madam Chair? Go ahead and respond.
I think our initial inclination on the response office is they would not be manned full-time. And we, for example, in say down at Cook Inlet, we are looking, I believe, at a warehouse. And before we make decisions about what goes in the warehouse, we want to evaluate the regional response capability to see what is already available through industry facility plans and vessels, commercial fishing organizations, et cetera. Our understanding is that the legislation last year is to the state to augment in a catastrophic spill situation. So obviously what we want to do is to complement the existing capability and be very careful about what we select that should go into the warehouse, so to speak, so that it does, in fact, complement what is available and provided by individual private facilities who are required under the law to have their own response capability.
Madam Chair, if I could,
yes, sir.
If I could just add one other thing. I checked Senate Bill 264 to see if my recollection was correct, and Senator Fisher, the bill does provide, the statute does provide for members of the volunteer corps to receive per diem and expenses for training and for days spent in service to to the state in containment and cleanup operations. So my recollection is consistent with our way of proceeding.
And I guess the last one has, when you develop a plan, whatever kind of it is, what effort do you make to make sure that the people that are going to be involved, in other words, the industry, understand what the plans are?
I might just say a word and then ask Larry to respond. In the Cook Inlet situation, the way we began the process of talking about what kind of response capability we need there, we're not talking about the specific regional plan yet, but what kind of capacity we need there and what the shortfall is between what we need and what we have, we started by sitting down with fishermen and other concerned folks in a meeting, and then we immediately went and sat down with the oil and gas industry and talked about the same topics with both groups, and that's the way we want to handle this because both have concerns and expertise that we need. Larry, do you want to speak to that?
I think you covered it.
The only reason I asked that question is I can remember when I was in the restaurant business and also as an employee at that time the health department, and the private sector really never knew much. In other words, we would say, well, you've designed it or you do the thing, then we'll tell you after the fact whether you approve it or not. So what would happen is small business guy would go ahead and do something thinking he's doing the right thing for the situation. And the agency would say, no, we're not going to approve that one. Instead of up front, spelling out this is what's going to be expected, and everybody understand what's supposed to happen. And that's what I would hope you do, that if need be, it might be a list, 20 pages long, at least, and if the industry or whatever just follows these, then they can pretty much rest assured that you're not going to say, no, we're not going to buy this idea, this plan's no good. And I think you have to work with people up front so they really understand what's expected of them, so they don't get caught into buying and instead of spend a lot of money and find out what they were doing that when they approved. So, and I don't know if you, when I was looking at
Senator Halford, do you have any comments or questions?
Not at this point.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would you like us out?
Let's just go. You can trade Larry for.
Let's keep Larry on tap and okay. Ask John McDonough, great. Assistant Attorney General, to join us. Madam Chair, John McDonough was given the challenging task of converting policy recommendations for the administration based upon the Oil Spill Commission's recommendations, converting those into statutory language. I should also mention to you that Denby Lloyd, Special Assistant for Resources, is here as well, and Denby was involved in the development of the policy decisions that you see here. The administration endeavored to follow the recommendations of the Oil Spill Commission. We have stayed in contact with Chairman Parker and are going to continue to work with him throughout the course of legislative discussions of these bills. In some instances, the administration's position and the governor's bills differ in some respects from the individual recommendations of the commission, but in every instance, an effort has been made to follow the spirit of the recommendation and to try to try to achieve a level of prevention, of spill preparedness, and of ability to recover if there is damage. And I think that's the kind of comprehensive package that you see here. What we've tried to do in developing this is to bring the different agencies together and develop a well-reasoned package. And I think that you will find that the package, the bills that are before you, the two bills that are before you, plus the other bills that are part of the governor's package, really do represent an interagency response, one that is key to the commission's recommendations, and that is a well-reasoned and thoughtful package. So without further general comment from me, maybe I can let John summarize exactly what these bills do.
If we could, within reason, kind of go section by section, starting with 503, rather than an overall.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. To begin, I just wanted to reiterate what Commissioner Kelso said. The drafting process, as I sat down to assist the agencies and the governor's office in drafting this bill,
really was an interagency process that led to an administrative consensus. And that consensus included and incorporated consideration of the Commission's recommendations. There are really three major themes or facets to this legislative package. The first is deterrence and prevention. In other words, while we cannot eliminate the risk, we can and should reduce it. Second of all, given that despite our best efforts, there may very well be a situation where prevention and deterrence is not enough. Effective response, ensuring that we can get out there and resolve the problem efficiently and effectively. And third, the notion of making the people of Alaska whole again, the notion of ensuring that there's an adequate recourse, adequate recovery. With those three concepts in mind, I'd like to turn to the bills themselves and take a look at them section by section. The first bill, Senate Bill 503, deals generally with response to disaster-type situations. And the bill does basically three things. First of all, it authorizes the governor to spend oil and hazardous substance release response fund money, that's also known as 470 fund money, during declared disasters. Sections 1, 2, and 4 of the bill accomplish that. I want to point out there that we're talking about expending those 470 fund monies in declared disasters. Those are disasters that are declared to be disasters under AS 2623. And the period of time in which the funding mechanism remains open to the governor's office under the bill would be the 30-day disaster declaration period. Sections 1, 2, and 4 of the bill perform that function. Sections 3 and 5 of the bill deal with the interplay between the Division of Emergency Services in the Department of Military and Veteran Affairs and the Department of Environmental Conservation. What both sections essentially accomplish, well, perhaps I should back up a second and state what the existing law is. Right now, under 4604080, DEC is assigned a variety of duties that normally belong to DES for catastrophic oil discharges. In other words, there is under existing law a sort of a block, if you will, of DES authority that has been placed by statute into DEC's responsibility, into DEC's responsibilities. And the whole thrust of what we did in this area was to sort of render to each agency that which it is most equipped, capable, statutorily assigned, and able to do. In other words, for example, DES has expertise, particular expertise, in the areas of communications, logistics, equipment procurement, manpower, public liaison, that sort of thing. DEC has extensive expertise in the area of directing cleanups, responding to oil spills. Indeed, DEC does that quite often. There are only two, as far as I know, declared disasters involving hazardous substances and oil spills, Crown Point and the Exxon Valdez, but DEC has dealt with hundreds of spills. So the notion is to let each agency perform that function which it is best equipped to do. And the way we did that in the bill was to change 4604080 so that DES now has returned to it all of the normal DES functions that DES traditionally has performed under AS 2623. By doing that, those areas in which DES has expertise are rendered onto DES, and those areas where DEC has expertise are rendered onto DEC. What we want to do there is avoid separating the overall direction of the spill response from the requisite technical expertise and the requisite legal authority.
Would you hold just a moment for a question from Senator Halford, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Teleconference.
Okay, thank you. With regard to this interplay, I guess you called it, between DES and DEC, the way you have it drafted seems significantly different than the recommendations by the Spill Commission. I mean, the Commission seemed to essentially say that the authority should be handled under Division of Emergency Services. You move one thing back to Division of Emergency Services, but leave operational control clearly in DEC's hands all the way through, it looks like.
Mr. Senator, through the chair,
We understand that concern, and as I said, the language that I drafted came about as a result of the various agencies looking at those commission recommendations and coming to a consensus for the administration.
So the way that section is drafted is an administration recommendation which differs from the recommendation of the Oil Spill Commission.
Through the chair, Mr. Senator, the thrust of the commission's recommendations, as I understand them, was to make the spill response more efficient and to obviate, avoid some of the problems that we've seen. It made sense to the administration each agency has, by virtue of its long-standing statutory mandate, by virtue of the technical expertise, the personnel that agency has on board, is equipped to do a certain function and to do it better than any other agency. DES, by virtue of those statutory provisions, by virtue of the people that are on board at this point in time, have very important and very crucial roles to play and very valuable expertise in the areas that I mentioned, logistics, equipment procurement, manpower, public liaison, communications. However, it was felt that DEC, which knows, for example, how to do sampling, how to determine the degree of cleanliness in a given situation, how to measure pollutants, how to keep chains of custody for retaining evidence, all of these things that DEC does not just once every 10 or 15 years, but does literally hundreds of times a year, that it performs those functions better than any other agency would be able to perform them. So again, the idea was to render unto Caesar what was Caesar's, to give each agency the authority that it was best equipped to handle. And we felt that there was a substantial problem in the existing law because a portion of that DES authority had been years ago ceded, a very important hunk of authority had been ceded to DEC. And that's how we addressed the commission's recommendation, by ceding that back to DES.
Under Section 3, the department issues an order, and that's, I assume, DEC.
Yes, Madam Chairman.
So this really doesn't pertain to the governor's having made a declaration of an emergency, a disaster emergency. Does the department's order follow that declaration? Why do we have to then have an order? And then second part of the question is, it says each state, and now the change will say, each state agency shall take whatever action the department finds necessary to meet the emergency. I understand that gives back to, or gives to, Military and Veterans Affairs perhaps more authority than they had in 2620, but it sounds to me like it also gives a bunch of other agencies a bunch of opportunities to decide, from DNR to, I don't know, Commerce. I'm not sure what Commerce would do, but goodness knows they know how to do measuring and stuff like that. So it seems like you're expanding it even further.
Madam Chairman, the Section 3 is really a cleanup amendment, and there's a degree of confusion here, and I think that the degree of confusion results directly from the very poor wording of the existing statute. Section 3 deals with a particular provision, 4603865. 4603865 has nothing to do whatsoever with declared disaster emergencies under AS 2623. Nothing that we normally think of in terms of a declared disaster or this interplay between DES and DEC really comes to bear here. The problem is that it's very confusingly worded right now. What 4603865 deals with is not declared disaster emergencies, and not with the interplay between DES and DEC in those situations. What it deals with is DEC's emergency order authority. This is very different from declared disaster emergencies and response in those. And let me give an example. If DEC were to look at a tank, and that tank, just pick any tank, that tank looked as though it were preparing to burst at the seams, or if DEC were to come upon any other imminent environmental release of a radioactive material, it's listed in the statute, oil hazardous substance, DEC needs to be able to look at that tank and say, tighten those bolts, or put a patch on it. It has nothing to do with a period of declared emergency or a period of disaster. It's simply DEC's emergency order authority, DEC's authority to tell
anyone out there, this is an emergency situation. We're going to have a problem here. Do A, B, and C, and do it right now. Fix the hole in the tank, or put a patch on that hole, or whatever. The way the legislation is drafted now, though, it uses some loose language about periods of emergencies declared. And we're really not talking about that. We're talking about emergency orders here. So what we did, when we went back and fixed 4604080, we decided that we'd also clean this language up to make it do what it's supposed to do. So we made it clear that when the department issues an order, the state agency will take whatever action the department says is appropriate, rather than during a period of emergency declared. Because that old language made it look like DEC was being given authority over the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs for declared emergencies and things of that sort. And that was never the intent or purpose of that provision. So what it says right there, given that, there's no reason to treat Department of Military and Veteran Affairs or hold them to any different standard than any other agency. If there's an emergency order issued, that issue, if it's a DOT tank that's sitting out there getting ready to leak, DEC could issue the emergency order to DOT. But this was never designed to in any way impair Division of Emergency Services or Department of Military and Veterans Affairs authority, and we wanted to make that very clear. So we simply removed that language. It doesn't increase anyone's authority, not DEC's, not anyone else's.
When the Department of Environmental Conservation declares an emergency order, does it have a time certain or a period certain, like governor's emergencies have a 30-day period, or can these go on forever?
The emergency order is just that. It's an order that simply says, you do this. And by the nature of that order, the fix is going to be immediate. And the action will be taken up front. There is no 30-day period. And this is why this language, during a period of emergency declared, was so confusing, because it made everyone think of 30-day disasters. And all we're talking about is, here's an imminent threat. You have to do X to stop that imminent threat, put the patch on or whatever. You do it and you're done.
And Commissioner, if the department declares, when you issue an order, I guess you declare an emergency smaller than a disaster, but bigger than a red box, and you issue an order, does that money come out of the 470 fund for that response?
Madam Chair. If I could just clarify, when we're talking about an emergency order here...
I hate having two attorneys trying to clarify things.
Well,
I may have apologized to Mr. Dietrich way too early.
Sorry, John.
Okay.
When we're talking about an emergency order, we're not talking about an emergency declaration.
Right.
When I issue an emergency order, it is for a specific problem that has, and there's the statute says what conditions have to be met in order to justify an emergency order. And my emergency order is intended to resolve that emergency. It stays in place only as long as the emergency condition continues. Example, a current one, Drift River. I have an emergency order in place that was the trigger for working with Cook Inlet Pipeline and with the other agencies in order to make sure we had a safe operating situation there. That emergency order is still in place, but it has served its purpose of moving this whole safety effort forward. But of course, the emergency situation still continues because the volcano is still erupting. But it isn't the kind of thing where we're declaring an emergency and then funding becomes available for...
What's in the bill is what isn't in the bill. Because the way I read the recommendations of the commission, they clearly wanted to see the authority within Department of Military Affairs. And just reading from their recommendations, states should establish community-based response depots under the management of Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. And they go on, persons trained in emergency systems to mobilize a large workforce quickly and with the required urgency tend to be better equipped to respond to a major spill. And they go on, under the direction of Department of Military Affairs, dealing with local volunteers, part-time spill responses, trained volunteers. But recommendations 43, 44, and 50 and 51 clearly said that the commission thought that Department of Military Affairs was better equipped to be in charge once you had an emergency. And I think somewhere in here they talked about Department of Military Affairs is better suited than DEC to carry out operational decisions. DEC is better suited to provide quality assurance, auditing functions, and to give advice, as is the role of DEC in relation to private spiller in charge. And I'm curious that the commission recommendations in this particular area don't seem to be followed anywhere near to the degree that they're stated in the commission report with the legislation.
Okay, let me try this and see if I, Mr. McGunnan, see if I understand what you're doing. Section 3, which is subsection C of 4603-865, doesn't really deal with the governor's declarations and emergency response to major disasters, catastrophes, and whatever else we want to call them. This is simply a cleanup of some other language because while you were there, you thought it'd be nice to clean it up.
Well, very, very close, Madam Chairman. The language was very confusing, and when we went back and looked at the other language, and everybody was throwing these terms around about declared disaster emergencies and emergency periods, we had the same problem that I think we saw here, is that we looked at that language and we thought, we're not talking about periods of emergencies declared. So, yes, it was a cleanup.
So, in essence, the commission, rightly or wrongly, didn't really deal with the Department of Environmental Conservation's ability to respond to a particular incident with a declared emergency and doing an order to say to somebody, you go do that.
The commission did not tell us to go in and clean up this language. In general, I think the commission wanted to strengthen response. And when we looked at this, it was confusing. So we tried to clear it up so that that confusion would no longer be there. I don't think the commission's goal was to look at this particular 4603 and find out what language was confusing. But since we were trying to clarify the role of DES and DEC, we thought it would be very useful to avoid using this reference to emergency periods when that really isn't what that statute is designed to do. We didn't expand or detract from anyone's authority by this change.
Okay. Senator Halford, I think when he gets to Section 5, you get to make your speech again. The same thing.
Yeah. Well, it's not so much what's there, it's what's not there.
I understand. I know. I understand what you're saying. Okay. Now that we all think we know what's in Section 3, let's go on to Section 5.
Section 5.
Mr. Fisher, don't you want to get your Senate Bill 503 out and... be puzzled, too. Oh, he's got it now. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Section 5 is the provision, basically, that accomplishes, in conjunction with, we can just set aside the Section 3 cleanup language. Section 5 is the provision that actually takes that piece, that hunk, if you will, of DES authority, which is now residing in DEC, and moves it back into DES. And as I said, the purpose behind that was to allow each agency to make best use of its own expertise and thereby to achieve the Commission's goal of an effective, efficient, and coordinated response. The way that was done in the drafting is to delete the language that says that the department, in other words, DEC, shall perform the duties of the Alaska Division of Emergency Services as they apply to catastrophic oil discharges. And that was the language that took this DES authority and placed it with DEC, and again, we moved it back by deleting that language.
Senator Halford, do you have a question?
No, that's okay. I'll slow down until you figure it out.
We can be here.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
With your permission, maybe I could suggest two things that would address Senator Halford's point. One is, if I could ask Denby Lloyd to join us briefly, I think he can clarify the process that was followed here and the reason that the administration approached it this way. Then I know you're going to be hearing from Walt Parker, and Chairman Parker, I think, has given considerable thought to how the various provisions fit together and which ones are the highest priority, and also understands that the administration is trying to meet the spirit of even those that where the functioning of specific provisions seem to fall out for a slightly different approach, and he may wish to speak to it as well. But if you permit a moment or two with Denby.
while Denby's coming forward, I understand that 4604080 deals only with catastrophic well discharges, and that's why we only talk about moving the responsibility from DEC over to DES in Section 5 under catastrophic well discharge. Where did you do the same thing for hazardous substances and not just oil?
The only place in the statutes, in DEC statutes, that gives that takes DES authority and gives it to DEC was this one particular section. And then since our goal was to give that authority back to DES, this was the only section that we had to change. For all the rest of the aspects, DES retains its original authority under AS 2623. So it was never ceded to DEC to begin with. I would point out, and we'll get to this in a moment, but Section 6 of the bill, which creates the Alaska State Emergency Response Commission, places that in statute and gives both DES and DEC very important roles in that commission. That commission is, in many ways, going to look at what's going on the ground in the communities with respect to how one actually distributes in a specific situation, in a specific region, under specific circumstances, this, where one actually draws this boundary between DES and DEC in a specific situation. That's the sort of local planning function, again, that I think is in the spirit of the commission's report. The spirit was to provide that local planning function and allow them a meaningful role, allow the local communities a meaningful role, and we address that through the CERC. So some of these specific questions about where a line would be drawn in a specific instance are going to be decided in, you know, a given factual context, and the best way to do that is to provide a general statutory framework and then establish in statute the Emergency Response Commission so that it can draw the lines in specific cases and specific localities.
Mr. Lloyd?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. For the record, I'm Denby Lloyd, Governor's Special Assistant for Natural Resources. Hopefully we are just concentrating now on Section 5, which was the administration's attempt to comply with the Commission's major recommendation of returning to the Division of Emergency Services their authority to conduct all the operations that they are best able to conduct under a declared disaster. Please be aware that there are many instances in the state where you would have small spills, one barrel, several gallons, that the Division of Emergency Services would not be called on to participate. And DEC conducts those operations either by themselves or in conjunction with the owners of those types of materials on a routine basis. And we would not expect to have emergency services operate on a regular basis on non-emergency situations. But certainly on a disaster that is declared as such by the governor, we saw the wisdom in the commission's recommendation to have the Division of Emergency Services basically take charge of those functions that they do best under all other emergency situations, earthquakes and flooding, where they are not so interested in curbing the instance that caused the disaster. Certainly DES is not going to stop an earthquake. But they are very capable in addressing the communication, the logistic functions of helping people affected by that disaster respond and respond quickly. Similarly, in an oil spill, the Division of Emergency Services is best able to conduct those functions. This statutory change is the only change necessary to return those functions back to the Division of Emergency Services. It's the only statute that currently takes that authority from DES and gives it to Denny Kelso's operation, and we saw fit to change that back. But to leave the oil spill cleanup functions that the Department of Environmental Conservation conducts on a very routine basis with that department, that's basically a summary of our thinking on that, and I believe it does comply with the major intent of the Commission's recommendations. However, I'd be happy to entertain any questions if there are any.
Senator Halford?
I'm trying to figure out the wording. The actual or imminent occurrence of catastrophic oil discharge constitutes a disaster emergency under 2623. In the event of a catastrophic oil discharge, the department shall consult and coordinate its duties under this chapter in 4603 with the Alaska Division of Emergency Services. So it really, it becomes kind of a coordination of nothing statement, where, I mean, you could have turned that around to say, to clarify that the responsibility is with emergency services. And I guess what you're saying is there's nothing else that takes it away, so it would be there anyway. But, you know, it could also say the department shall support essentially the division of emergency service in the performance of the division's duties. And then it would be very clear that it was the Division of Emergency Services that were in charge in those cases.
Madam Chairman, the other provisions of AS 2623 that are not addressed here in this particular paragraph set out the duties, the regular duties of the Division of Emergency Services under any declared disaster. Those required no amendment. However, we would like to keep distinct the oil cleanup functions of the Department of Environmental Conservation and leave those to DEC. So the only change that was required to keep DEC from performing what is already DES functions under other emergencies was this type of change.
I don't think you've got 26.
Pardon?
I don't think you've got 26. You just got 46.
This paragraph currently only references catastrophic oil discharge. We would like to see DEC remain in charge of the actual cleanup. However, under any disaster emergency, under AS 2623, with this change, the major responsibility for the state's overall effort for the emergency itself would be with the Division of Emergency Services.
Well, Senator Halford is looking at that. Do you know if we have Mr. Parker online yet? Just so we'll know if he's there. Bear with us. I guess, Commissioner, could you tell us, because I really don't remember, what role then did DES play in the initial response to the Exxon Valdez? I was under the impression that DEC pretty much ran everything.
Madam Chair, the Division of Emergency Services was present with us in Valdez at the Oil Spill Response Center. DES worked with the Department of Administration in setting up the communication system. DES arranged air transport for the early going in the spill. We actually used a combination of Air National Guard equipment and Civil Air Patrol equipment. DES also took an active role in those things which were not spill containment and response, spill containment and recovery of oil. For example, Pete Werpel from the Division of Emergency Services was involved every day in our operations meetings. Pete served as a liaison with the city of Valdez and spent a lot of time on things like emergency housing, emergency public safety measures, coordinating with the Department of Public Safety. That whole side of the picture that is not directly spill containment, recovery of the spill, and the associated work that is what we normally would do, and which we do, for example, several hundred times a year in other spills. But DES was very much involved. I have to say that we have the highest respect for Pete Werpel, who was in there with us every day, and we learned a lot from him. We support making sure that the statute does restore this authority. It would allow DES to do what it does best, and it would allow us to continue in the role of being able to oversee and direct the spill containment, recovery of oil, and other direct spill response activity.
Well, let's go back to the incident command system, if you will, that we were talking about in response to Senator Kelly's and Duncan's bills from last year. I think that the crux of the question to me is, who is the person who has final authority for all of this? Did the DES person I mean, somebody had to say yes or no. There couldn't have been two people down there. So who is the incident command officer or head person, and from what department or agency, or who decides who that person is, and who has the final authority for the state?
Madam Chair, the incident command system is built around the idea that you have the authority to conduct a function in the entity that's best suited to do that work. So that, for example, if we're talking about a logistics function, that would be...
I understand all of that, but in the military, right. Some one person is always in charge somewhere. So under the system, who's that one person for the state?
The incident command system is designed as an alternative to a military command structure. It is not intended to be the same.
There isn't any one person in charge?
With respect to the direct scope response work, let's talk about the function.
Right.
With respect to the scope, containment, recovery, the scope response, the direct scope response work, the Department of Environmental Conservation was and continues to be in charge. With respect to the other functions, the Division of Emergency Services took a very direct role, but because the statute is structured as it is, many of those functions were reviewed by the governor's oil spill cabinet, which was chaired by the governor's chief of staff. So in the field, you might have the Division of Emergency Services making decisions on a daily basis about how to deal with emergency housing in Valdez. That's not a direct spill response effort that we would be doing. But you'd also have the governor's spill cabinet taking a look at things like community mental health, public safety support, labor conditions and occupational safety and health matters to back up what was going on in the field. So if the question is who directs and oversees the actual spill response, the answer is DEC. If the question is who directs these other functions, I think Denby's already addressed that in a declared disaster, that really is a DES role.
Senator Fisher, and then Senator Halford.
Maybe you're not asking the same.
Somebody's not asking the right question.
And it's the governor.
Okay, so that if you're doing your job and all of a sudden you see that somebody's coming along and threatening to stage something to slow you down, you need the public safety to come in. You can't then go to somebody and say, hey, public safety's got to come in. Maybe public safety will tell you, but we just don't feel it's critical enough. And you say, my God, we need somebody in here to get these people out of here. Who's the guy, the governor? Then you'd have to go to and... It just seems like there should be some agency or one person out there that if there's conflict within the various agencies, they can go to him and he can say, Commissioner, whether you like it or not, you're going to do this.
And that's exactly what the chief of staff did in this bill. Yes. Now, there was no confusion about who had the authority and who had the responsibility to deal with the direct spill response. I mean, that's the authority that I have subject to direction by the governor. And there should be no question about who exercises disaster response authority in these other areas, like communications and logistics and the other things that are specialty areas for DES. But to accomplish that, we need to make this change in the statute.
Commissioner, the commission report, and I can't tell you which recommendation it was, but there was the commission said at some point in the report that one of the problems during the Exxon Valdez spill, as they saw it, was that shortly after the spill, the position as chief of response for the Coast Guard, for the state, for Alyeska, all three, was taken away from the person who most understood how to respond and given to someone who came in with higher authority but less understanding of the problems at hand. And in fact, they were very explicit about the Coast Guard and frowned upon their having perhaps used the spill as a training ground and cycling people through. I guess what I hear you saying doesn't give me any comfort that we're going to get away from that in emergencies in the future.
Maybe you can help me understand that, Madam Chair.
Well, I'll tell you what, let me hunt for that while Senator Halford asks his question, and maybe he's got it pegged himself. Senator Halford?
Looking at recommendation number 51, and not the recommendation as much as the backup that they put in. In their professional training, the normal professional complement of DEC consists of persons primarily trained in the measurement and evaluation of environmental quality. Such personnel are not as well trained in the skills of maintenance and mobilization of a workforce and equipment, communication, procurement, and the like. The personnel of the Department of Military Affairs are trained in emergency response, the mobilization of a workforce and equipment, emergency procurement, similar tasks. Department of Military Affairs management of emergency response gives the Department of Military Affairs a standing outreach into all Alaska communities, including personnel, equipment, a command structure, workforce, buildings, planes, vehicles, and et cetera. And the way I read that is that essentially the recommendation is that Department of Military Affairs be in charge, not DEC, once a major spill disaster has been declared.
Madam Chairman, I guess we're still getting confused on in charge of what? Of all the logistics and communication functions, mobilization, et cetera, that's the intent of this, is to return that authority to DES, but not for the actual cleanup. DES is not practiced in deployment of booms or choosing of sensitive areas that need boom protection, things like that, and that authority we are contemplating reside or remain with DEC.
Okay, I don't know if you've got copies there of the commission report, and if you don't, we can provide you with them. But recommendation 48 on page 48, just previous to the one that you just talked about, Senator, it talks about the formal command structure of the incident command system. And they say that a local on-scene commander can be pre-designated under the system. The function of higher officials, such as a federal czar, should be to see that resources are mobilized and provided, and not to replace the on-scene commander. They go on to say, in almost every command structure surrounding the Exxon Valdez spill, the individual most knowledgeable about the circumstances of the spill and theoretically charged with response was quickly replaced by a person who may never have read the local contingency plans even. The Coast Guard appears to have rotated personnel through Prince William Sound for experience. So they identify the Coast Guard in particular, but time and time again through the commission's testimony, through sitting through some of those hearings, through talking to people throughout the Prince William Sound area myself, one of the things that I keep hearing is there was no single person in charge. And that went beyond just being nobody knew whether the Coast Guard, Exxon, or Alyeska, or the state who had authority, but it was also within each command structure in each of those entities. And I don't understand how we're dealing with that under the structure that you have in the bill. Is that kind of the same as you are questioning, Senator Halford? Same.
Well, it is, and I mean, I'm not disagreeing with their point, but in terms of, you know, at some point you transition back to the scientific evaluation of cleanup and so forth,
right.
But the initial response needs to be a military-type operation, and I believe that the Department of Military Affairs has a much better chance of maintaining a fire department-type response than the DEC does. Now, maybe we should hear from the commission members to get some of the background of what they want and all this stuff.
Unfortunately, we never got Mr. Parker. He did not come to the Anchorage LIO. He is not online, so we don't have him tonight. Hopefully, we will have him tomorrow evening.
But at some point, you know, I think the scientific expertise, the regulatory expertise, the decisions on degree of cleanup, how to clean up, what to clean up, those sorts of things do rest with DEC. But in terms of the response to get something there, to deal with the logistics of boom materials, fire department response will work much better in Department of Military Affairs than DEC.
Madam Chair, with your permission, I'd like to ask Doug Dietrich to rejoin us for a moment.
Sure.
And while he's there.
If you keep Mr. McDonough up, you'll have members.
I'd like to ask, I can withdraw, Madam Chair.
In the sense of equity?
No, I said only if you bring him back up. You're fine, Denby. You don't go away. I'm sorry, Larry. Go ahead.
All I was going to ask Larry, I'd like to maybe to talk more with Senator Halford about this point. But before I do, let's make sure we're talking about the same things.
Okay.
I'd like to ask Larry to, to do two things. One is to give you a quick thumbnail sketch of what immediate actions are involved. This is not like fighting fire. This is not like sandbagging for a flood. This is a very different kind of response, and I'd like for Larry just to give you a quick picture. And then I appreciate the points you've made from the report, but I would like to make sure the record is very clear. There should have been no question. DEC was the state on-scene coordinator. We continue to be the state on-scene coordinator. We exercised our authority, including our emergency order authority, and we maintained our spill response expertise on site and in the on-scene coordinated role. So whatever may have been true of the Coast Guard does not hold true of the command structure that we used. We did rotate people in order to relieve people, but we used our most experienced people and we kept them there. So Larry, maybe you could speak to both of those.
Madam Chair? Well, let me just run through real quick what actually happened. Maybe that will address the number, because you brought up a number of good points here. There is a pre-established command structure that was in place at the time this spill occurred. It has been in place. It is laid out in federal and state law. That law provides for direction of the spill by the federal on-scene coordinator. In this particular case, it was a Marine spill. They had jurisdiction. The state on-scene coordinator is in a support role then to the federal on-scene coordinator. He is your number one person on this event. The state on-scene coordinator is the number two person. It's his function to coordinate the responding agencies on the state side. Those people were in Valdez on day one. Our pre-designated state on-scene coordinator is our regional supervisor for the South Central Alaska. In each region, that is our person who responds. He arrived on scene in Valdez on Friday. The pre-designated on-scene coordinator for our agency, should he not be on scene, is our first arriving field representative. So for a short, brief period there, our first representatives were in fact acting until he remained on scene. The command structure that is in place and has been in place for quite some time and is actually carried out quite effectively in this state between the Coast Guard and our agency was activated immediately. Our communications with the Coast Guard were excellent. Commander McCall was the first on-scene coordinator for the Coast Guard. He was there. The key decisions that were made in the first 3 days with regard to dispersants and open burning, which were the initial key decisions, along with the lightering decisions to offload the oil from the boat, were made rapidly. We had absolutely no breakdown in communications. If we couldn't get Commander McCall on the phone because the lines were so tied up, we simply walked over to his office. Our on-scene coordinator worked with him hand-in-hand on dispersant drops when they were done. The observation tests were done with a federal observer, with a state observer. The regional response team was called in. The decisions that had to be made were made, and they were made effectively. At that point in the spill, for about the first 3 days, of course, it was all in the pancake around the vessel in Prince William Sound. There was no, quote, disaster. Certainly none in Valdez at that point. DES activates when the governor formally declares this as a disaster. Pete Ruppel was in town, and we were already talking to him. I forget the actual date, but the governor's disaster declaration came in on about the second or third day, I believe. At that point, they could then mobilize the disaster relief fund and activate and carry out their duties. We worked with them. We basically turned over what they normally do to them and allowed them to do it. When our communications were faltering, we went to Pete Ruppel and asked him through DES to do what they normally do, and they carried it out. When we needed sky cranes to get boomed down to Chinook Bay, we went to DES and said, this is what we need. He knew what to do with the National Guard to get the sky cranes. Whether it was dropping the lighter pumps onto the vessel, the Exxon Valdez, or taking the containment boom down, it by and large worked. Even though at that time, the statute which we are talking about was on the books, we were supposed to be carrying out those duties. This change returns the carrying out of those logistical support things to DES. We recognize that, I mean, we were pretty busy ourselves tracking the spill and evaluating the impacts, making those initial assessments, gauging the vessel, collecting the evidentiary samples that had to happen. So the logistical support is what DES, in effect, was in charge of, even though legally at that time the statute is as it is now. And we did operate that way, and they did carry out those logistical support functions. And our communications with Pete Ruppel were in large part quite good. And by and large, they did what they do well. And we did what we do well. So I don't know if I would offer that to hopefully clarify some of these things.
Senator Helfer? Okay, Senator Fisher? Okay, thank you. I'd like to take a 5-minute break before we go to Section 6 and then on to the other bill, because I believe the commission idea is probably going to engender discussion again. So I have 7:35. Let's come back at 7:40.
Go ahead, Chair.
You just told me to take a
shot. And maybe I'm missing
the first time. We are on, Tim. Bill 503 on the last part, and it's the commission. Let's call the meeting back to order. Back with us is Senator Kelly, so we are at 4/5 strength anyway. And gentlemen, if you could continue, please, with Section 6, Chapter 13, the Alaska State Emergency Response Commission.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. As you probably are aware, there is established, by virtue of an administrative order right now, the Alaska State Emergency Response Commission. A federal law called the Superfund Reauthorization Amendment Act required that each state create an emergency response commission and required that commission to have certain functions. In drafting this bill, as I said, the existing CERC is a creature of administrative order, and therefore it's very limited in what it can do, because those entities that are created by administrative order, as you know, have very limited functions. What we attempted to do in the drafting in Section 6 was to establish that state emergency response commission in statute, to give that commission those things which federal law, in other words, Title III of SARA that I mentioned, requires CERCs to have, and to also expand that somewhat to cover the oil area as well as what is traditionally hazardous substances, is what are traditionally hazardous substances under federal law. So we created it, we hauled it basically from the administrative order, placed it in the statute, we expanded it somewhat to ensure that it covered oil as well as other hazardous substances. As I mentioned earlier, the commission does have and will continue to have under this proposed legislation a very important community impact function, a very important community participation function. You'll notice that the CERC is composed not only of the members of the commissioners of the variety of agencies that would be directly impacted in the event of an emergency, but also includes members of the public. You'll also note that CERC, that CERC is charged with the powers and duties set forth in what is proposed Section 46.130.30 on page 3 of the bill. And you'll also note that the bill also authorizes the commission to establish and appoint the local emergency planning local emergency planning committees, and to establish emergency planning district boundaries. Again, the purpose of those will be to help draw the line delineating what the function of each, not only each agency, but of each entity in the community that has to respond. Law enforcement, civil defense, firefighting, first aid, health, local environment, accessibility to hospitals, things of that sort. That planning function needs to take place at the local level, and we've attempted to address that in this fashion by creating the CERC and giving it the authorities we set forth in Section 6.
Okay. The commissioner spoke previously about the department's response to date on the two bills that were passed last year, Senator Duncan's bill for the statewide planning process, Senator Kelly's bill that sets up the response corps, the response depots, does the training, so on and so forth. Why is it, since they appear to be progressing quite nicely, that we need a commission?
Madam Chairman, first of all, one of the reasons we need a commission is because it is required.
I understand that. We've got the commission, but why do we need to put it in statute and have it go beyond the federal requirement? Why does it need to take over what the department appears to be doing quite nicely?
I think what we were trying to do there, and I'll let Commissioner Kelso speak to this, but what I think we're trying to do is address the commission's concern that we increase public participation and increase that participation at the local level. We felt the CERC was a viable entity for doing that, but maybe Commissioner Kelso could answer that better than I could.
Madam Chair, the Emergency Response Commission currently has
responsibilities in basically two areas. One has to do with hazardous chemical release and the planning and safety that goes into that in communities throughout the state. The second is community right-to-know provisions of federal law, so the communities can know what hazardous materials are located in their communities so that they can protect their first responders, whether that's a local fire department or a local police department or an emergency crew that's part of the municipal government. What this would do is to give assurance to the local communities that in statute the legislature is recognizing the role of the statewide emergency response commission and the local planning districts, so that the local planning districts may develop into the key organizational elements for the regional response plans. The idea being that if we can get the Emergency Response Commission and the local planning districts to do double duty here by covering oil spill as well, then that may be an economical use of resources, and it may provide the most natural unit for building those regional response capabilities. For example, the local emergency planning district for the Kenai Peninsula is the Kenai Peninsula Borough. That's a good unit to work with when you're building a regional plan and carrying out the local response elements of that. So this was just an effort not only to give assurance to local communities that they really were going to be built in, and that this just wasn't only through an administrative order, but also through the direction of the legislature, and also to try in the most economical way that we could think of to make sure that there was this direct access to the process of building the statewide plan and the regional plans in a way that really works on the ground.
Okay, if you don't mind me asking, I wonder if Mr. Dietrich could come back to the table, because I'd like to ask him and join the two of you. Don't disappear again. But oh yeah, he's here. He's here. He's just there. Mr. Dietrich, last evening in talking about Senate Bill 359. And the municipality's concerns, the oiled mayor's concerns, specifically those communities' concerns about being a part of the process, which you heard them talk about. At the first sections of that bill, in Title 29, gives those municipalities the power to, through ordinance whatever's, through their own powers to pass their own laws to respond if necessary to an emergency. What the department was concerned about was that you wanted them to do that in the realm of a larger plan, and that you wanted there to be some consistency. If we give them that power and we say that we want consistency, would it be your judgment that we still need to provide, through there being a commission versus just the department? I mean, I don't understand how having seven people from throughout the state on a commission is going to give the department or give the municipalities a comfort level that they're involved when we are going to give them the authority to actually, through their own, in Title 29, to set up their own response capabilities, basically.
Yes, Madam Chair. At this point, I think through the regional planning process, we have to come to conclusion on exactly what the local response structure should look like. I would comment at this point that the Kenai Borough, I believe, is in the lead in the state in brainstorming how to organize their community to be able to respond to a spill. They are proposing a multi-agency command system that would include incident command systems from representative communities within the borough. The final form as to how a community will respond, whether it's on an individual village basis or individual municipalities, or whether it's at a borough level, I think is what needs to be defined in the regional plan, and that's why we've invited everybody into that process. It may well be that in the case of the Kenai Borough that their preferred option will be to orchestrate their response through the local emergency planning committee, or through the borough MAC group that they're looking MAC group structure that they're looking at right now. I think in other cases there may be isolated villages
where they're isolated enough that they would have an individual part of a regional response plan that they would implement. So there may be more than one form of local response capability that we're leading up to here.
I just don't understand why we have to have the commission do this when it seems to me that the department through the interagency working group is I know you're going to go to a public process, not hearings per se, but you've said that all of these things are going to happen without having to convene 15 people around the table to tell you can go do it. Senator Kelly.
Well, Madam Chair, I'd like to ask if the Alaska State Emergency Response Commission was a recommendation of the Oil Spill Commission.
Senator Kelly, the Oil Spill Commission recommendations called for a strong and clearly articulated role for the local communities. Since the State Emergency Response Commission and the local emergency planning districts are already available as a structure, and they're already required to do certain kinds of emergency response planning, it seemed sensible to make sure that structure was available also for oil spill. Now, it's certainly not the only structure you could choose, but since it already exists and we don't have to create a new one, and it is consistent, I think, and directly supporting what the commission asked for in the way of a stronger local role and a continuing local involvement, directly in line with recommendations 49, 50, and 51.
Did they recommend that it be headed by the DEC?
I don't think that they couched their recommendation specifically, but that the Department of Environmental Conservation currently chairs the Emergency Response Commission, and the vice chair is the Division of Emergency Services in the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs.
Just to clarify that a little bit, when we took it from the administrative order in terms of drafting, we pretty much stuck as much as possible to the structure that was already there. So a lot of the language in terms of purposes, functions, membership and all was a carryover from the existing administrative order.
When was that administrative order promulgated?
Madam Chairman, Mr. President, I don't have the order with me right now. My recollection was it was promulgated in 1987. It would have to be post-1986 because that's when the federal law requiring it was passed. I believe it was 87. I can check that. I'd be happy to check that.
Do you have a copy of this?
We do. We do have one. We'll get it for you, Tim. Got one downstairs. Any specific questions on that from either Senator Halper or Senator?